From KCRW, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is a program of stories and personal documentaries, radio movies. And on this episode, a girl gang goes on a violent rampage of sex, larceny, and murder.
The world won't miss his missing chromosome.
Behind the scenes of a film made during the chaotic birth of the 1970s punk movement in London.
And he was snarling, jumping up and down and spitting, and then Vivienne Westwood came on with Jordan, and they were doing the same thing in their outrageous costumes and bad-mouthing the audience and spitting at the audience. I mean, it wasn't, oh, love me, it was like, hate me, because I hate you.
On this episode, Derek Jarman's film, Jubilee, told by the three women who were at the center of it.
It was my first ever movie. I think I was a complete pain in the ass.
From KCRW, it's Unfictional and Punk Jubilee. From KCRW, I'm Bob Carlson. And producer Victoria Farron brings us the story of the glorious mess that was Jubilee, the 1973 punk film from director Derek Jarman. It's Unfictional and Punk Jubilee.
In 1977, in the UK, it was the Queen's Silver Jubilee. And there was a great, immense, patriotic celebration. But it was also the moment when punk was really breaking through into the consciousness of the ordinary people. Forced into the limelight by people like the Sex Pistols, Malcolm McLaren, and this great confrontation.
Something had to come from the kids. The industry had run out of ideas.
Torn clothes are held together with safety pins. There's lots of black leather and bizarre hair.
If these kids weren't on the stage playing music, they'd be out on the dole or in prison.
Susie and the Banshees.
What did you see?
The Lord's Prayer via Twist and Shout, Knocking on Heaven's Door, and a bit of Deutschland, Deutschland, Uber Alle.
Derek Jarman's Jubilee is a very unusual film and involved people who are at the very heart of the punk scene.
Life in England these days is inflationary. Coping with misgovernment and idiocy on every side.
It's got a special spot in that time. Derek was arrested at one stage in the middle of it.
This is the generation who grew up and forgot to lead their lives.
Feel bored, join the National Front.
Jubilee is said to be the first and only punk rock movie.
No future!
But I think Derek Jarman just had a vision about the changing world at that time.
My name's Jenny Runniker, and I was in a film called Jubilee. It was the second film made by Derek Jarman, set in punkdom, when total anarchy is actually ruling the UK. Everything's been burnt down or destroyed, and it's anarchy. I play the role of Queen Elizabeth I, and also, it's dual roles, that of somebody called Bod, which is short for Boadicea, who's the leader of this girl gang that go around creating mayhem.
Shut your eyes, angel.
I captured it in Deptford.
It's an unusual document of punk. It's absolutely a product of the time, but it's still clearly very much Derek Jarman's sensibility and vision. My name is William Fowler, and I'm curator of artist Moving Image at the British Film Institute. Derek Jarman worked in lots of different mediums. He made films from really 1971 up until his death in 1994. He was also very visible and sort of loud promoter of gay rights. He became known as this political artist in the UK and had all this glamour surrounding him and a kind of aura around him. He worked in a very experimental way, so he was blurring forms. He was an amazing collaborator as well, so I think the actual process of making the film was often more important than the finished works. I mean, I often think of his films as like happenings, which is perhaps not a punk thing, it's more of a 60s thing. But this sense, I think, of working with outsiders, if you like, and this raw sensibility is clearly like a very punk thing.
The early effect of punk clothes was to shock the general public, especially the inventive use of the safety pin. Jordan worked at Seditionaries, a clothes shop owned by Malcolm McLaren, the Sex Pistols manager. I am an anti-Christ. Malcolm and his girlfriend Vivian's highly original design formed the basis of the first punk dress.
The whole punk wasn't engineered, but Malcolm McLaren, Vivian Westwood, you know, they're incredibly astute people, avant-garde people. Fashion designer, and Malcolm was an anarchist. He was basically a born anarchist. He was the one who sort of discovered the Sex Pistols, definitely. He was virtually put together by him. In their shop, which is first called Sex and then called Seditionaries, everybody used to gravitate to the outfits they had there.
It was almost like a pilgrimage, if you like, of people that came from all over the world to this little tiny shop, which was very difficult to get to. It was right at the very end of King's Road. Late last night after I went to bed. My name's Jordan Mooney. I got a demonic feeling in my head. When I first went to work at 430 King's Road, I used to wear a leotard and tights and very, very tall stilettos, a lot of see-through, transparent clothes, rubber latex and leather.
Why do you do it? Why do you dress outrageously? Why do you spend 8 hours getting your hair spiked like that?
Why does Picasso paint pictures?
Because the Sex Pistols were made by Malcolm, I became part of that styling and helping and making sure that they looked good. And I went on lots of gigs with them.
Everybody knew there was this whole new movement going on in London, and we used to go clubbing all the time. I was friends with Derek, and because he was a historian, he had a history degree and an art degree, he was totally aware of social change. It was such an exciting movement. He wanted to do something about it, make a film about it.
He knew all these people and this underground street scene that was connected to sex clothing. At the same time, he was quite a lot older than the punks. But I think because of his queer sensibility and the approach that he had to filmmaking, he could connect. Through his friends Andrew Logan and the studio art scene by the River and the Thames in London, you know, he was actually one of the first people to see the Sex Pistols first perform.
Andrew Logan was an artist. Andrew started doing these things called the Alternativeness World. Everybody dressed up in all sorts of outrageous clothes.
And here we are.
One of them, Derek One.
Alternative Miss World, Miss Carriage, Miss
Andrew used to have these enormous parties in this old warehouse in Shad Thames, now the financial city of London. But then it was just old warehouses, huge old warehouses. A lot of artists lived down there because they were incredibly cheap and they were empty and they were rotting and it was totally abandoned.
The Sex Pistols played a very, very special gig there one evening. And it was announced to me mid-gig by Malcolm McLaren that it was the first time NME, which is the New Musical Express magazine, very influential magazine, had come to review the gig. His words to me were, "Go on, George, get up there and get your clothes off. It would make all the difference. It's really important. It would put us on the map and blah, blah, blah." So I said, "Well, if John Rotten is willing to do something, if I go up, he'll have to do the rest."
I mean, it was actually incredible because Johnny Rotten came on and he was snarling, snarling at the audience and jumping up and down and spitting. And then Vivian Westwood came on with Jordan and they were doing the same thing in their outrageous costumes and mauve makeup that Jordan used to wear. And they'd be bad mouthing the audience and spitting at the audience. I mean, it wasn't, "Oh, love me, love me." It was like, "Hate me, hate me, because I hate you."
John pulled my clothes off. He actually pushed me right on the floor naked from the waist down, John did, and there's some really great pictures of me which you can't tell which way is up because I'm squashed on the floor.
It was just outrageous. But at the same time, it was riveting. I mean, I remember watching them play, and you could actually feel your hairs and neck going because it was so raw and original.
There's been lots of stories about when I first met Derek, and he says that he met me at Victoria Station and was completely knocked out by the way I looked. So I think I'd probably have to defer to his late memory, really, on that.
He definitely wanted Jordan, because Jordan was a huge punk figure.
He was on the scene, and I did meet him at Andrew Logan's parties lots of times, and he did visit the shop, and that's where the whole of the Jubilee project took shape.
Here we are in a taxi going towards the British Film Institute archives in Berkhamsted. Wow. So this is where it's all kept.
And if you see over here, I've put out some material from the Derek Jarman collection, which is all associated with Jubilee.
Okay, let's have a look at it then. I recognise Derek's writing there. So what's this then?
Well, he put together notebooks for all of his films at different stages of production, and this is the one for Jubilee. As you see, it's this very imposing looking volume with decal.
So it says, Jubilee, a stunning film which promises to be the movie of 1978. Although it isn't a punk movie as such, Jubilee contains many of the elements of the punk movement, attacking the basics of our society with no compromising. One stormy winter night in 1578, Queen Elizabeth is at the home of the great magician and alchemist, Dr. John Dee.
John Dee. Some pretty distractions, which you call angels, call forth to forget.
He proposes to take her on a journey into the future, and he summons the angel Ariel to be their guide. Ariel arrives in a great clap of thunder and promises to show her the future. The future will be as black as her beautiful glittering dress is white.
All hail, great master.
Rather than just directly mirroring or documenting the scene as he saw it, he involved this very unusual technique of having Queen Elizabeth I from the 17th century with her occult aide, Dr. John Dee, contact a spirit, the angel Ariel. The angel Ariel then transports Dr. John Dee and Queen Elizabeth I into the future.
This vision exceedeth all expectation. Such an abstract never before.
With all these punk characters, where the world has been taken over by big business, having Richard O'Brien playing this very restrained occult specialist going around with Jenny Runacre is really extraordinary. I mean, there aren't really many films like that at all. Curiously, there's also Brian Eno music in the film. Brian Eno, not really associated with punk, although long-term countercultural figure, helping to draw out Jarman's mystical associations.
And there's me as Elizabeth I. My costume was the exact replica of what Elizabeth would wear. So you've got the drawings in the colours that it would have been in, which is black, white, so creamy colour, and the little orange embroidery. We've got a swatch of material. We've got writing, mostly, which is Derek's, but I think some of that could be actually Christopher Hobbs. This is a bone corset, because in those days they used to wear bone and wood corsets. And it goes right down, the front of the corset goes right down here to sort of right in front of your crotch, actually, so it's quite comfortable. And you didn't wear knickers underneath. Loads of pearls, yeah, loads of pearls. Because I was swathed everywhere in pearls. The other costumes weren't that expensive. I mean, the suit that I wore as Bod was my suit. Because when Derek and I were talking about different things, he said, well, I saw you in a suit once, why don't you wear that? So that was my black suit. And then I had trainers and just my hair scragged back. I think I was sort of like representing anarchy, just anarchy. So I wasn't a classic punk. I was a symbolic figure that was leading the girl punks. And that's the crown I stole from Queen Elizabeth II.
I'm going to make it into a crash helmet. That'd give it some use.
That would be distinctive. Why didn't you steal the pearls as well?
I never liked pearls.
The shadow side to existence is what the film is about. So the punk future is the shadow side to Elizabethan England. And the Jenny Runacre's two characters are like the shadow side to each other as well.
Oh, here they all are.
Yes, this is a list of thoughts he's had. There's little Nell. This is heavy, scary sex. But in fact, she didn't. She actually wore lots of little bikini briefs and bras. She looked very pretty. She's actually the only one who has sex. The rest is a sort of weird, sadistic kind of sex. There's lots of murders when they're all going, well, killing, 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 which is sort of like a perversion. That's Gene October, the guy that we smother with polythene. Is Ian Charleston, unfortunately dead, lovely actor. And that's Carl Johnson. There's Toya with a machine gun.
Do you know any real heroes?
No, I don't.
It was my first ever movie. I think I was a complete pain in the arse. Hello, I'm Toya Wilcox. I'm a singer, actress and writer. I was 18 when I moved to London, Christmas 1976. I was invited to join the National Theatre. And Ian Charleston realised that Derek might be interested in me, and he took me to have tea at Tregunter Road, where Derek was living at the time. So here I am in Derek's apartment, and there's a script on the sofa, and Derek goes out to make tea, and he said, look through the script, choose a part. I leafed through it, and I looked for the largest role available, and I chose Mad. And Mad appealed to me because the anarchic energy of the character had a lot of potential. So Derek came back in. I said, I'd like to play Mad. He said, yep, it's yours.
Toya Wilcox was someone that Derek Gelman discovered and cast her in two films, in fact. She subsequently had other acting roles and became a punk pop star, if you like.
Derek didn't say anything to me about how he wanted me to look. He just said, please would you go to this hairdresser? And I went to Keith Wainwright at Smile on the King's Road. If you look through the history of music from 1969 right through to present day, David Bowie, Mark Bolan, Brian Eno, Brian Ferry, he's done everyone. But Keith shaved my head down to about a quarter of an inch of hair and then dyed it bright orange, which back then was very, very aggressive thing for a woman to do. I mean, the world could not handle female punk rockers. But then Derek saw it. I met up with him. He took me to a fishing tackle shop on Shaftesbury Avenue where we went to buy fishing waders, which went right up to my crutch, big rubber boots. And then when I wasn't in that, I would wear industrial overalls. So that was it. Mad was born, this pyromaniac.
And there's Borgiakins, Blind Orlando. He was even more expressive because he couldn't see, so he did everything with his mouth. There's me standing there. This is watching Adam Ant's band play, actually. He's like, I've got to take you down to Harley Street. Oh, yes. This is the plastic surgery. One of Adam Ant's songs. And he actually performs it in the film. Well, you can have a brand new nose, light blue eyes, or even
hazel. A little ear will be much better when you are. The Adam Ant performances, I think, are really, really excellent. They're almost like my favourite music that he's ever done, which are just recorded on set and they're playing live. Plastic surgery, it's so plastic. Weird lyrical themes, abrasive guitar, very much live in the moment. Punk hadn't really solidified. I think when they're playing these songs, they're kind of exploring the form and they're really electrifying performances.
Lots of punk bands play, Adam Ant, Wayne County, Gene October, another punk. So there's lots of music in it, and every so often Queen Elizabeth I comes back and says, England, what's happening to you?
Girl Gang are very, very violent. And it follows their journey through their love of music and a character called Kid, played by Adam Ant, getting him signed to a music promoter, but the music promoter is more interested in real estate.
He's called the Kid, but he's pure sex.
I'm gonna be his manager.
I'll take him into the theatre
and audition him.
Adam Ant was physically stunning, film star looks, but he still needed a lot of, I think, emotional protection. My sense of it was he was quite intimidated by the fact that Derek Jarman flirted with him. I felt that Adam couldn't quite cope with that.
Sort of had to convince Adam a bit to do the film. And he wore all of my clothes for plastic surgery, Adam. It's my whole outfit that he borrowed. I had a series of letters from somebody who was anonymous. And eventually I found out that these letters were coming from somebody called Adam Ant. He eventually asked me if I would manage him, which I did. I was a living ideal of his perfect woman image, because he's always been very much into that sort of dominatrix, leatherware, rubberware, not in a sexist way, in a, like I think, a beautiful, tactile way.
I think there's a story that Jordan carved something with a razor blade in Adam Ant's back, so that when he was walking around, he had cut in writing on his back.
He came to the shop one day. I thought it would be a good idea to get a Stanley knife and carve fuck into his back as a sort of real-life tattoo. You know, he did nearly faint. I haven't inspected his back recently, but I think it's probably still there.
Plastic surgery.
You're signed up. Now, what are we going to call you? Scum! That's it! That's it! Scum! That's commercial.
Derek allowed us complete creative freedom. He would put us on the set and he'd just say, well, I'd like you to walk there, and then go over there and finish here. What you do in between is absolutely up to you. And a combination with me of nerves and natural, very high energy just meant I was like a jumping bean. I'd just go ballistic on every scene. It was, yeah, I'm in front of a camera. This is fucking great.
Who are you writing this crap for, Emil?
Myself. It's a hobby.
And the first scene I had to shoot was a 10-page scene. I was terrified, absolutely terrified. And it's a scene where I'm reading from a book and I'm walking around the warehouse and the two incestuous gay brothers are in bed together and I end up jumping into bed with them at the end of the scene.
I'm a damsel in distress.
And we did it about three times and I was enjoying it more and more every time we did it, getting bigger and bigger in my performance. And then in the end, I had to jump into bed with Ian Charleston and Carl Johnson. They're both utterly naked, and I just froze. And Derek said, what's the matter? Is there a problem? And I said, I've never been in bed with a naked man. And the whole set just burst out laughing. I was so naive. It was unbelievable.
All right, girls. We are now proud to welcome Miss Amyl Nitrate. England's glory.
I really liked the character of Amyl Nitrate, and Derek saw that in me as well, that I could bring more than just words to the film, but the dancing.
There's Amyl. She dances a Rule Britannia, but to the goose step.
My God! It's Amyl Nitrate!
Like Rule Britannia dance, it's a real piss take.
She's England entry for the Eurovision Song Contest. She's my number one!
It's me miming to Rule Britannia, which was sung by an opera singer. I spent ages singing it and learning it at home.
That feather there is the mauve feather that she was wearing, and she's got a Union Jack on and a T-shirt, and those are green tights, black suspenders, black bondage shoes, a helmet, I think, that Chris Hobbs made.
I've got a trident, which I dance and gyrate to, and obviously Britannia's helmet. And it didn't fit, so Derek had to lend me his beret to put underneath the helmet, because the helmet was too big. Both that and Jordan's dance ballet, I did just completely impromptu.
Jordan had previously been in one of Derek Jarman's Super 8 films called Jordan's Dance, which is briefly incorporated in the film, actually. And I think for Derek Jarman, that was the heart of the film. And that's this extraordinary punk character wearing a tutu and doing a ballet by the side of the Thames. And I think Derek Jarman was attracted to these kind of strange collisions of different elements: beauty, fire, punk, destruction.
I started to dance. I want you to defy gravity.
I did it in probably two takes, mainly because point work is usually done on a stage. It's not done on concrete, and it's not done on a place which is a bomb site, which is covered in rubble. It was extremely painful. I mean, I had blood pouring out of my feet after that. I got quite badly burned on my legs because the bonfire was very big. But I loved all the camera work on it, and I loved that Derek got the absolute most out of the whole thing.
This is notes. The scene is a flashback. The film was deliberately scratchy and degraded, printed in red. It was a large bonfire. The slits are burning books. Amol dancers in an austere classical tutu. All these beautiful guys all standing around with masks on, naked.
The men with Greek masks, actually, is a rather well-endowed chap there. I think that your eye travels too quite quickly. But also what is great is this guy that's cutting his hair off, which was all real, and burning of books. It's a deep moment for him.
He's written, capitalism, greed and envy, social mediocrity, whilst at the extreme stood the handmaidens, fascism and Marxism. What's this like?
Whores,
like whores under the banner of progress. This is all that film was about, you know.
Mentally and intellectually, the whole process was very, very organised. But then we had the brutality of money. Jubilee was not a big budget. I believe it was £360,000. And he'd compromise his own comfort to put all that money into the movie. That's when he became anarchic.
Derek was arrested at one stage in the middle of it. He did a scene, which is still in the film, of the policeman on the bike with guns. Somebody called the police, because, of course, our police officers don't carry Kalashnikovs or big machine guns, and they thought they were real. And also, you know, you had to have permission to clothe streets and what have you. And he just turned up in his wonderful way and just set up a scene to film there.
Our shooting schedule. Tuesday, flat 31, 100 Lancaster Gate. Bod, Amol, Mad, Krabs, Chaos, Wayne County. That must have been the murder scene.
Who's that?
Lounge Lizard. You think he's still alive?
Never heard of him.
Yeah, that's my line here. Because I'm saying, we see this guy gyrating on television, that's Wayne County. And I go, well, I'm glad it's a man. I always get a twinge of remorse when it's a woman.
The world won't miss his missing chromosome.
They're going to kill him. And that's the first time they realise. And then she goes, ah, Bod!
You're crazy, Bod! I love you!
My name is Wayne Jane County. I'm known as a punk rock trans pioneer. Jordan was frequent on the scene, and that we always were running into each other. And Jordan was telling me that Derek Jarman was doing a new movie, and she wanted to bring Derek to see me. And I was doing a song called Paranoia Paradise. And Derek Jarman thought that Paranoia Paradise would be perfect for his movie. And I was going to play Lounge Lizard. I got a demonic feeling
in my head. Oh, there he is. Wayne, now Jane County. Pull my legs apart. In his orange negligee, is singing Paranoia Paradise. Yes, he's got this pink kind of organdy dress. I think he made himself. Paranoia Paradise. Bright orange wig, sort of like a Afro wig almost. Immaculate makeup and long red fingernails. That again wasn't particularly rehearsed. Now he just said, "You're going to kill him with a microphone."
Good evening.
This is Miss Slaughter here.
bringing you the very latest and important world events. We have Lounge Lizard.
She practically jerked my teeth out with the microphone. I almost screamed in the middle of the filming to stop, you know, but I got so much into the scene.
I am sorry.
I thought if we had to stop, the scene wouldn't be as good as it would have been with me showing a little pain and displeasure.
7 records with you of your own choice.
Oh, yeah, no, this, ugh. The thing is, you get so into that, a lot of films you do, but with Jubilee, I got so into it. I did things that now I look at and think, how could I have been so violent? It's not at all a good portrayal of women.
The violence didn't shock me. I know it shocked a lot of people at the time. It was only by the skin of its teeth that it got a certificate. What happened was the ex was refused. Derek had to go to James Furman, the censor at the time, and talk to him seriously, because this was the future of the film he was talking about now. James Furman mentioned several things that he found that were completely and utterly unacceptable. One was the castration scene of the cop that Toya and I do.
I remember vividly shooting the sequence of attacking the policeman. The policeman had murdered the 2 bisexual brothers and they'd murdered Kid, played by Adam Ant. So we'd gone after them to get our revenge. We were by the River Thames, near Tower Bridge. Derek took myself and Jordan aside. So he said that it could be as violent as you wanted it to be. And I remember talking to the actor playing the policeman, and I said, look, are you okay if we make real physical contact? And he said, yeah. He actually allowed the violence to happen. Because I don't believe for 1 minute I could have physically done that to anyone.
Where's the razor? Where's the razor? I'm going to castrate him!
And Derek said, just take it right through as far as you think you can take it. So I just kind of went with my instincts on it and just kicked the shit out of the character. Which led to this incredible emotional release and realization of how contained violence within you, or if you are holding some kind of grief or some experience where you've been hurt by others, if you hold that within you, it controls you. And by killing this policeman, it was a form of therapy. I hate to say that as a human being now, but that's how it unfolded.
And then in the end, we all go down to Longleat, which is owned by the Marquess of Bath. It's got a great zoo there. Borgia Ginst takes us down.
Wonderful, Borgia. Is it all yours?
It used to belong to some aristocratic family. I requisitioned it.
Derek's vision was very accurate. I mean, people aren't yet killing each other in the streets, but unemployment and the disaffection, there's no jobs, out-of-control gangs. The premiere was one of the Gate cinemas up in Curzon Street, and I remember there was a whole lot of critics there. A lot of them got up and walked out, came out with very mixed reviews, disgusting and everything else.
For some people, they felt, I guess, it was kind of a little bit deep, a bit art-based, and quite the antithesis of what maybe a lot of punk mentality was about at the time.
I think one thing that really hurt Derek is the way the established punk movement turned against the film, because they said it was exploitation, and you can see in a way why people would think that. You know, making a commercial movie and the punk movement, never shall the twain meet. You got
a face. Vivienne Westwood, I think, really hated it, and she had made an actual T-shirt in response to the film, one of which is actually in the collections of the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. And it's a long text that she's written, just basically slagging off the film. But one of the things that jars with her, and I can understand that, is that it has Queen Elizabeth in it, and there's this Elizabethan English language in it, and there's almost like a celebration of an older form of high-class culture in some way. And that's one of the things that she picks up on. I think the T-shirt is also homophobic as well.
Oh, John Dee, do you remember those days? The whispered secrets at Oxford, like the sweet sea breeze, codes and counter-codes, the secret language of flowers. Mrs. Elizabeth.
Were my eyes then as now with your celestial geometry? You laid a path through treachery and opened my prison so that my heart flew like a swallow.
Now is the time of departure, the last streamer that ties us to what is known parts. We drift into a sea of storms. That's it. Stage directions, the whole screen darkens until we have the titles.
Punk Jubilee was produced by Victoria Farron for Just Radio Limited. The sound engineer was Chris O'Shaughnessy. The contributors, Jenny Runacre, William Fowler, Jordan Mooney, Toya Wilcox, and Jane County. I'm Bob Carlson, the producer of Unfictional. The editor is Nick White. The associate producer is Carla Green. The theme music is by Alex Weston. Music help from Joe Augustine and Narrative Music. Please subscribe to the podcast of Unfictional wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find photos and all the past archives of the show at kcrw.com/unfictional. Please join me next time for Unfictional from KCRW.